Okay, as we ended last time, we were showing ourselves how many questions we can ask of but two verses. About this time in the semester, students begin to get worried because they think, my goodness, we've just spent 20 minutes on two verses. How many verses do we have to cover? This will never end. Well, we're not even done with these verses, but let me assure you that we cover things in different levels. Sometimes we're flying overhead, taking aerial views. Sometimes we're walking on the surface. Sometimes we're digging little trenches. So it's like archaeology in all its various forms. Well, right now we're going to dig a little trench and ask how we would go about answering these questions we've asked, or at least some of them. We mentioned last time some of the tools. You do want to reflect and explore answers to your questions using the tools that are available. The first tool that was mentioned very astutely by one student was the Bible, of course, and then also such things as a concordance, a Bible dictionary. Those are very basic, major tools. What about this question, why the death of Moses? Why is the death of Moses mentioned? Why, if it's not to simply alert Joshua to the passing of this significant individual, I think Joshua knew about it. So why did God say to Joshua, Moses, my servant, is dead? What background would we be able to dig up to, sorry for that use of dig up, but what background would we be able to discover that might enlighten us as to why this is significant? What is significant about the death of Moses? What had been said about the death of Moses? It ties us back to Deuteronomy and the end of Deuteronomy. What is the relationship of the death of Moses and the promised land? Okay, Moses was not going to enter the promised land, and there are a number of references that indicate that, the first of which would be Numbers 20, verse 12, and then I could give you Deuteronomy 1, 37 to 38, and Deuteronomy 3, 23 to 27, and on and on and on for about six or eight more references. The death of Moses and the fact that he is not to enter the promised land because he had not honored God before the people is significant because until he dies, the time is not right. When he dies, God says, okay, Moses is dead. Now's the time. Now's the time to move. They had been waiting and being prepared. So that's, I think, the reason God mentions the death of Moses, not to give Joshua information he didn't have, but to say, now's the time. Now it's time to move. And that invokes all that background and causes us to go back and explore it, which we shan't do tonight for reasons of time. What about the question you asked about the servant of Yahweh, the servant of the Lord? Now, how would you go about exploring that? You could look that up, perhaps, in a Bible dictionary. Some Bible dictionaries would have an entry under servant, maybe servant of the Lord. You might be able to do that. Another thing you could do, which I'm going to take a chance and see if I can project from this computer onto this screen just to show you how this stuff works. Another thing you could do would be to do a computer search. And don't be bothered by the fact that I have, in just a minute, I'll put it up here. I'll see if this comes up. Whoops, did the wrong button. Don't be too bothered by the fact that there's Hebrew up there. Just read the middle column for the time being. And what I'm going to do is run a search on servant of the Lord. This, by the way, this program is called Accordance. And it's a very, very good, powerful program for doing computer searches or doing Bible searches, concording searches. And you can do a lot more sophisticated searches than just servant of the Lord. But here we notice, just looking at some of the references, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab. Apparently, the first time Moses is called the servant of the Lord, according to this search at least, is when he died. Okay. Again, then in Joshua 1:1, he's called the servant of the Lord. Again, it's Moses. I'm going to jump on down. Joshua 1:13, Moses, the servant of the Lord. 1:15, Moses, the servant of the Lord. We can't take time to read all the context. Joshua 8:31, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. Joshua 8:33, Moses, the servant of the Lord. 11:12, Moses, the servant of the Lord. 12:6, Moses, the servant of the Lord. And again, Moses, the servant of the Lord. Can I just say ditto? 13:8, ditto. 14:7, ditto. 18:7, ditto. 22:2, Moses, the servant of the Lord. 22:4, ditto. 22:5, ditto. 24:29, Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord. And then in Judges 2:8, Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord. It seems that this is more than just a throwaway sort of accolade. This is truly a commendation that Moses received when his life's work was done, and that Joshua receives when his life's work is done. And you see this just by doing a quick computer search. Now, it does, not a concordance search. I'm not saying you all have to run out and buy computers, but it is the wave of the future. So start saving your money. They're great. They're great if they don't take over your life and if you don't buy computer games. Okay? But they're very good for many things. We could go on and see that there are some other important individuals. You get more references to Moses, the servant of the Lord, in the book of Kings and indeed in Chronicles. Most of these, let me just rush on down. David, the servant of the Lord. This is not a commendation that is used lightly. Moses, Joshua, David, and then some unspecified individuals wherein it will say the servant of the Lord came and spoke to so-and-so, and we don't know necessarily who that might be. Isaiah 42, the first of the suffering servant passages, who is blind but my servant, or deaf as my messenger whom I send, who is blind as my dedicated one, or blind as the servant of the Lord. What all that means, we'll leave to the class in prophets. But you see that you can very quickly get an idea of where this phrase is used. Now, it would be more accurate if you actually did Eved Yahweh, you know, servant of the Lord in Hebrew, because sometimes the Hebrew is going to be translated one way and maybe sometimes another. But this is at least roughly accurate, and it does confirm that this is a title that one receives when one's life's work is done. Now, can you see this? I should have asked. People have been staring at the board as if they can see this. Some at least can. Maybe from way over there you can't, but you can trust us. All right, so I'm going to turn this off now and move back over. You can see that does work. And in the days when we can dim the lights, it's even more visible. So, servant of the Lord. You can go at that with a concordance or a Bible dictionary. It's important, perhaps, to ask that question. As with many of the questions that we put up on the board. Another question was, who is Joshua? Who is Joshua? Well, if you began to research that, you might do a concordant search, or you might look it up in a Bible dictionary, and you might discover that Joshua had another name. What was his earlier name? Hosea. You read that in Howard's book, also in the Bible, if you read that. If you read in Numbers 13:8, his name was originally Hosea, and then Moses changed his name. What did he change his name to, Joshua? What does that mean? The Lord saves, as in Yahweh saves. Hosea, we think, means something like salvation, but Moses wanted to make it more specific. The Lord saves. Maybe Moses knew that this would be significant, that Joshua would need to recall who saved, because indeed Joshua is being given quite a heavy responsibility. We also asked, when we were putting questions on the board, what does it mean that he was Moses' aide? Well, there you can find a number of references if you just go back and look for verses, let's say, that have Moses and Joshua in the same verse. You can run that kind of search, and it will turn up a number of instances where we see Joshua functioning as Moses' aide. And we can begin to see what Joshua experienced. His life included the Exodus. He's one of the few survivors of the Exodus, or those who survived from the Exodus. He had also been involved in military leadership. You remember the battle against the Amalekites, which is recorded in Exodus 17, when Moses held up his arms and needed some help even doing that. Well, Joshua was leading that. We also know that Joshua had knowledge of the land into which he was now to bring the people. He was one of the 12 spies that had gone in Numbers 13 and 14. We discover that Joshua was the closest person to Moses on Sinai or in the tent of meeting. It says that he was waiting for Moses when Moses would come back from having an encounter with God. Joshua would be waiting for him. So we see in so many different ways, and this is just really rushing over the surface, we see in so many different ways that God has been uniquely preparing Joshua for the task to which he now calls him. So it's important to know that Moses is dead. It's time for new leadership. It's time to enter the land. it's important to know that Joshua was Moses' aide, that he had been learning from Moses and he had been a part of so many of those experiences. So God has prepared him. And then as we move on through this particular chapter into verses that you didn't explore in your five-minute session, we learn, for instance, in verse 3 that God begins to use, actually in verse 2, he begins to use a verb that recurs many, many times in chapter 1, the verb give. Did you notice that in verse 2? Cross the Jordan River into the land I am about to give them to the Israelites. Verse 3, I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. If we were to speak in theological terms, we begin to get a little bit of divine sovereignty, divine beneficence. God is going to give the land. God is giving the land. But we also get a hint of human responsibility. Because he doesn't say, here's the deed, go put it in your safety deposit box, does he? He says, I'm going to give you every place where you set your foot. In other words, as you go, I will give. And that give is repeated over and over and over again in this particular chapter. Then we come on down to verse 5. And here I think we get Joshua's charge, the essence of Joshua's charge. And this is a nicely structured little section, so I want us to look at that a little bit as this night begins to wane and we'll need to knock off in a while. Let's look at this particular section of Joshua's charge, because I think it had something important to say to him and something important to say to us. Look at verses 5 to 9, and I want you to look for repetitions. Look for what words or phrases are repeated there. I'm going to give you maybe 2 minutes to find some repetitions. That's easier. And then we'll see what kind of structure begins to emerge. My sense is that it hasn't quite been 2 minutes, but I'm going to interrupt you anyway because I think you've probably already discovered some repetitions. What did you find that's repeated in these few verses here? Be strong and courageous. All right, that's definitely repeated. What else? Okay, observe to do. Now, is that repeated or is that simply stressed? Okay, let's see. In 7 and 8. Right, okay. Yeah, some of this has to do with translations as well. Be careful to do. Right, okay. Yes. Okay, obey the law so that you will be successful. Yeah, there's a couple of mentions of success. Let me just highlight what I think is the dominating structure. Those really the first two repetitions you mentioned, I think, are dominant. You have be strong and courageous, and you have I will be with you. You have I will be with you in verse 5. No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. And that is paralleled in verse 9. Do not be terrified, do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Promise of divine accompaniment. Now that is sort of the frame. So I will be with you, I will be with you. The Lord will be with you. So in verses 5 and at the end of verse 9, we have sort of the frame, which is then the charge given to Joshua. Now, the charge given to Joshua involves three repetitions. Do you see any, threefold repetition of be strong and courageous, do you see any variation within those repetitions? When we see repeated matter, we look for variation to see if that might be significant. Yes, Jennifer. Okay, at one point it says, be very courageous. At what point is that? Okay, the central mention of be strong and courageous. So you have be strong and courageous, be strong and very courageous. I'm going to abbreviate, and then again, be strong and courageous. Now, do you think that's just a rhetorical flourish, or do you think that may be significant? Yes, sir. Be strong, vigorous, and very courageous. I'm not sure where your translation got that. What translation is that? Okay. What it's probably doing is translating one word twice. And I don't think there's a change, really. I don't think in the Hebrew there's a difference between that, be strong and courageous, and the first. I need to check that, and I have my Hebrew on computer, but I don't have my Hebrew Bible here with me. I think those two phrases are probably parallel. Yes, in the back corner. Gee, I really should. I wish I had my Hebrew open here. This is crazy that I didn't bring it and I'm not opening it right now. In verse 7, be strong and courageous. Right. Yeah, I would have to look to see if that... Oh, good. Yeah, I'll run over here and grab it. Thank you. In verse... Yeah, that was in verse 9, did you say? Verse 7? Okay, verse 7. Yeah, that is attested in the Hebrew. It says rock, which means only. Okay, only be strong. Okay, in other words, it's kind of a an emphasis that's there. So yeah, that's valid. Well, let's look at what Joshua is being charged to do. God gives him three times this order to be strong and courageous. For what purpose? What's the first thing he will need strength and courage in order to do? Okay, to lead the people, he's being assigned a task. Okay, now I'm going to say task to accept his task and to fulfill his task because I want T words, okay, to make it memorable. So he's being asked to lead them into the promised land. He needs to be strong and courageous simply to accept the task being given him. So he needs to be strong and courageous for the task. He needs to be strong and very courageous for what purpose? No, not temptation. She's just going for miscellaneous T words. the Torah. Yes, a good guess. Right, because the next one says, "Be strong. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law." Law is Torah. Now, Torah means more than just the legal portion, but the instructions of God. To be careful to obey all the instructions my servant Moses, remember Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. So he needs to be strong and very courageous to obey the instruction, to do it by the book, to obey the law. Now, there's a little homily in here somewhere, and I think... It's this, at least to me, it's this. It takes a certain kind of courage to even accept a certain responsibility or to take on a task. Often, it takes even greater courage to do it God's way. To do it according to His instructions, to not bend the rules, to not try to fix it yourself, to not try to go after it yourself, but to pay careful attention to the way God says this task should be fulfilled. And we will see in the book of Joshua, which will spill over to next time as you anticipate, we will see in the book of Joshua that at a point in his life, Joshua faltered a little bit in terms of following the Torah, following the instruction. When was that? Just to anticipate. With the Gideonites. What does it say about the Gideonites? Yeah, they tasted the stuff they had brought along and they looked at them and they looked like they were from a far country, but it says, but they did not inquire of the Lord. They didn't get God's instructions on that particular affair and it ran them into disaster. And that's the way life is. That's the way the Christian life is. Whatever courage it may take to get started and to accept the task, we need to have the courage to do it God's way, to continue to be faithful to His instructions. Now, there's one other T word maybe we can find. He needed also to be strong and courageous for what reason? Not to be terrified, okay? Let's say to face the terror. Some people refer to the Christian walk as, some people refer to Christianity as a crutch. There are some terrifying aspects to walking by faith and being a Christian. Now, it is a great assurance to know God and to know that He oversees our circumstances and to know that we're in His hands. That doesn't mean that what He faces us with in life is any easier than what others face. He just faces them with us. So it is a help in life, but it's certainly not a crutch. And there are some terrifying aspects to the Christian walk in general and to Christian leadership in particular. And I hope you're part of the leadership and not part of the terror that other Christian leaders sometimes feel in the churches. If you feel you've been terrorizing your pastor, you may want to try to change your ways and be more supportive. Okay, so he's charged to be courageous for these reasons. He needs to accept the task. He needs to be ready for the discouragement that will come or could come. And be strong and courageous. Don't be discouraged. Why? Because God is with you. God is going to be with you at each stage. Now, let me jump back and comment on one other thing that could be easily misunderstood. Notice in verse 7 it says, "Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful." Now, what does that sound like? Yeah, it sounds like health and wealth gospel. It sounds like something we might be able to tune in on television. That, you know, if you get right with God, everything will get right in your life, you know, and you'll suddenly become wealthy and successful. As a teenager, I remember being at summer camp and a man whom I highly respect and learned a great deal from, and so I hate to mention this and I won't mention his name, but this man was teaching that from this text, that if we would have our quiet time each morning, that God would raise our grades in school, that we would begin to experience, if we would just be careful to obey the instruction and read the Bible and be obedient and such, that it would guarantee that our grades would go up. Well, it may be, in fact, that if people talk to God each day and that kind of discipline creeps into their lives and such, it may bring their grades up, in fact, but that's not what's being promised here. What is being promised here is a different kind of success. And you could demonstrate this from the Hebrew word itself, but the kind of success is success as God defines it. That is, fulfilling your mission. Then you will be prosperous. Then you will be successful in your way. B'chol asher telech, everywhere that you go, in your way you will be successful. What kind of success is this? It's the success of getting where you're supposed to be going, God's way. And it's where God is sending you. It's not where you might want to be. So it has nothing to do with your physical prosperity or your physical health or your physical well-being. It may be that God has suffering in store for you. Think about what servant of God was more successful than any other servant of God who has ever lived. Who was that? Well, Job, but I mean, I'm speaking of a human being who is exceptional in another way. Who? Jesus. You know, we think of Jesus as God, which he certainly is, but he is also a human being. And he was more successful in his following God than anyone else who has ever lived. How well did he prosper? Well, in health and wealth gospel terms, he didn't do too well. Didn't make it past 33. But he perfectly fulfilled that for which he was sent and was able to say, "It is finished." That is success. You know, and that's what we need to gear ourselves for, whether we are Christian followers, and we need a lot of Christian followers, or whether we're Christian leaders. Whoever we are given this kind of charge. You know, God is with us, so we must be strong and courageous, and we can rest assured as we follow His lead, as we read His Word and obey His instruction, that we will succeed and prosper, but as He defines it. And it may be success and prosperity through great difficulty. I mention often that Jeremiah, the prophet, spent most of his ministry in the bottom of a well. And yet he succeeded. God told him in advance, "No one's going to believe what you have to say." And yet he succeeded because he obeyed. And so, you know, in our own lives, as we think about where we are right now and what struggles we face and such, we may not be able to fix the circumstances, but we can begin to experience success overnight. Success as God defines it, as we turn and really begin to follow Him and say, "Lord, I'm going to follow You throughout this circumstance, whatever it brings." Now, maybe that's a good note to close on, and let me just see if there are some questions. We will pick up next time in Joshua, and we will kind of... you notice I've given you a rather somewhat detailed outline there. Let me just say one word about that. I do not give you that outline so that you run off and memorize that outline. I want you to become familiar with your outline that you made. I just give it because we're going to talk through a bit of it next week. This is one that I made up when I was working through the text. And we'll talk about certain aspects of this outline outline next week. But by all means, don't go off and say, well, I'm going to use this one rather than the outline I made. The one you made is the best outline because you're in it. And it will bring to memory all the things that you thought about as you were creating that outline. So use that. Now, we do have 3 minutes, as I hear the notebooks clicking all over this great auditorium. So if there are questions or comments or things that you'd like me to talk about next week. Now, there's a lot more to talk about, I know. But if you think I'm going to overlook it and want to ask a question now, do so. Yes, Mark. By all means, let not my inability to keep pace cause you not to keep pace. It's always this way in my life. It's just good that I'm now the teacher and can get away with it. But no, you've got to get through a certain amount of information, whether we talk about it all in class or not. So you stay right on schedule with the reading assignments. By the way, also on the outlines, when we come to Samuel, you'll notice that 1 week you have 1 Samuel 1 to 15 due, and then the next week, the next half. Don't turn in an outline until the book is completed. So until the book is completed, you don't need to turn in an outline. But when 1 Samuel is completed, then turn it in. Yes, sir. Yeah, will we be covering the significance of really the genocide of the Canaanites and virtually everything else that breathed? Yes, we will. In fact, you'll notice on the assignment schedule or the lecture schedule that we're going to talk about debating points in Joshua and Judges, and one of them is this issue of holy war and the genocide of the Canaanites. And there is a reading assignment to go along with that from Meredith Klein. So yeah, we'll get to that. Whether we'll fully resolve it is another question, but we'll definitely get to it. There are some things to be said about it. Any other questions, comments? Yes. Yeah, they were speaking Esperanto, I think it was. No, that's a good question. The West Semitic, Northwest Semitic languages, Canaanite, we don't have a lot of remains of the Canaanite language, but what little we have suggests, and also Moabite and so forth, and Ugaritic a little farther north, all of those Northwest Semitic languages were quite similar. In other words, they were probably as close or closer than German and Dutch, if I can make a very rough comparison. So that even if they didn't know one another's language, they could probably have communicated reasonably well. Now, on the other hand, at a fairly early stage, perhaps not this early, but at a fairly early stage, Aramaic, really more than 9th century, Aramaic became kind of the lingua franca, the language that was a trade language that many would have known. But there may have been something like that operative at this time as well. Yeah, Hebrew is a Northwest Semitic language. That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about that one. So my answer may be completely lame. Yes. Any other questions? All right. Well, we'll stop on time and arrive on time next week. See you then.